Hi, and welcome to How to Ruin Dinner, Conversations in Religious Studies. This is your host, Mary Trays, coming from you from the University of North Florida, where I am sitting in my little sound booth that has been put together for me by Andy Rush. And I am very excited today and so pleased to introduce our guest, Dr. Woody Holton, the McLaughlin Professor of History at the University of South Carolina. Dr. Holton is a prize winner, the 2000 Merrill Curdy Award for his book Force Founders, Indians, Debtors, Slaves, and the Making of the American Revolution in Virginia, was just one of several prizes. In 2007, he was a National Book Award finalist for his work Unruly Americans. In 2008, he was granted a Guggenheim Fellowship, and in 2010, he won the Bancroft Prize for his research on Abigail Adams as an investor. I first heard about Woody on another podcast, The Ezra Klein Show. He was discussing his newest tome, Liberty is Sweet, about the causes and people behind the Revolutionary War. All the people, the English Parliament, the generals, the debtors, women, native people, slaves, and soldiers. I became interested in the reassessment of American history through the 1619 Project curated by Nicole Hannah-Jones. That project investigates how racial policies shaped America, from economics to social norms and music to interstates, real estate ownership to government programs that incentivized and privileged European Americans over African Americans. Nicole Hannah-Jones's work asks us to rethink American history from the perspective of a caste system. Woody Holton's work also seeks to decenter the traditional narrative of American history by looking at the motivations behind the revolution, not the ideals. For our series on activism and activists, his work is certainly relevant. And I've come away from his reading his work with a sense that our contemporary concerns and actions can lead us to significant societal change and that revolutionary is reactionary. We should be alert to what is motivating us. Hi. Woody, thank you for coming on this podcast. I'm so happy to have you here. We're going to be talking today to Dr. Woody Holton III, right? We'll start right there. And I'm going to let you introduce yourself by way of asking my last question first, and that is, could you tell us a story, please, about how you have ruined dinner?
I could tell you many, but mostly involved me forgetting that I left the stove on, but maybe most relevant for what we're talking about today, my sister brought home a boyfriend from law school in the 80s. And I actually don't remember this, but we're still in touch. And this boyfriend swears that he was very apolitical, but he sat down to Thanksgiving dinner with the Holton family, which is extremely political, and that the big report that he had for his own family after it was all over was that we'd gotten into this hot political debate over Social Security that ended with me storming out of the room.
Oh, great.
Thanksgiving dinner. So that's how I ruined a Thanksgiving dinner.
Oh, that's great. Well, maybe
my boyfriend, by the way, did marry my sister and went into politics too.
Is that Tim Kaine? Are we naming names?
We may.
Okay, well, that's a good story. I would think he would be used to combat.
Well, he is now, but it started at my dinner at my family's Thanksgiving table.
Oh,
he was not a political guy before that.
Oh, that's amazing, actually. Well, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your father and how you grew up and how you became interested in American history.
Yeah, Dad was elected in '69 as the first Republican governor of Virginia. And this is back when Virginia Republicans were Lincoln Republicans, and that made them really unpopular with the white majority in Virginia because they were still bitter about Lincoln. You know, to take my wife's, the place where I got married, Vicksburg, Mississippi, they didn't celebrate 4th of July in Vicksburg until I think it was the 1970s, because that's, of course, the day they were captured in the Civil War. Virginia was kind of like that, too. There were a lot of people who didn't like Lincoln. And so Dad had run for lots of offices before that, but did get elected governor in 69. And one of the things that he was dedicated to was racial justice. And he got tested on that right away. That's an easy enough thing to say. But the court decided the following, I want to say April, to integrate our schools. We'd had token integration before that. There were no Black kids in my elementary school in Roanoke, Virginia, growing up in the 60s. One Black girl in my class once we'd moved to Richmond. But I was zoned into a school that had almost no white students before. And as governor, he could have sent us to any public school in the state or, of course, private school. But he said, no, this is the law and we're going to comply with the law. And it turned out to be so wonderful for my sister Anne and my other sister Taylor and me and my little brother Dwight when he came along to be a minority for once and to learn from this vibrant culture. You know, this was the era of, I don't know if you remember, Shaft.
Yes, of course. But
you know, that stuff I would have missed if I'd stayed in my boring lily white schools. And one activity that I remember my first African-American teacher at Mosby Middle School did was it was a Ray Bradbury short story that had been turned into a play. And long and short of it is it's science fiction. So all African-Americans have just gotten sick of it and moved to Mars. And then the whites all mostly kill each other off. But the few survivors get on spaceships because they've ruined Earth. They go to Mars and say to the African-Americans there, will you please take us in? We'll now be the second class citizens like we treated you. And some sort of Morgan Freeman character comes forward and says, yes, we'll take you in, but we're going to treat you the way you should have treated us. And so the reason I mentioned that story is that I was one of the few white kids in the class. So I got to play the white guy who asked to be taken in. And again, you know, would that have happened if I'd stayed back in my segregated school in Roanoke? Absolutely not. So of course, the point of school desegregation was to try, and we're still trying, to equalize educational opportunities for African-American kids. But I felt strongly and still do that I was one of the biggest beneficiaries of school desegregation. It was the end of my father's political career. He was elected to one office in his life, and that was governor of Virginia. And you know, Republicans, as I said, were Lincoln Republicans, a few Democrats, they'd split, they went along with him. But after that, Nixon took the Republican Party down the road of the Southern strategy, which was to stir up racism, basically, as the Democrats had done for decades before that. You know, that's how they ran against Lincoln in 1864, trying to replace him as president, was if you reelect Lincoln, he's going to make your daughter marry a Black man. That was Democrats in 1864 saying a lot like what some Republicans say very sadly now.
Wow. I mean, it's flip-flopping of ideals and ideologies and tensions is really fascinating, isn't it? What a great upbringing. We are talking about activism today. Did your father see that as an activist position? I mean, the way you described it, he saw it as the law, and he was going to follow the law, very traditional kind of attitude in some ways. But outside of that idea, certainly the country, I grew up in North Carolina, and I went to an integrated school, but it was a Catholic school. So there were Black and white people that went to school there, but it was the the public education was definitely segregated still at that time. And, you know,
can I make a point about that, Mary? I teach now at the University of South Carolina, and one of our recent PhD students who got his PhD was writing about, we have, I think it's the number one Army induction base in the country. This is about a mile from my house, Fort Jackson. And the point is, Truman integrated the military in 1948. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the beginning of Nixon's Southern strategy, was that the Democrats had associated themselves with civil rights, first Truman and then more famously Johnson. But anyway, when you integrate the military, you integrate military schools. And so what the student of ours wrote about was, what was it like to be a white lady, as most school teachers were in those days, living in your segregated white neighborhood, going to your segregated church, all that. But then you go teach in an integrated classroom. And those schools were integrated. The military schools were integrated a long 20 years before the rest.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought about parochial schools, though. That's worth looking into as well.
Yeah. My little school and the little town of Southern Pines was integrated, but there weren't a lot of Catholics who were African-American, as you can imagine. So you're talking about only a handful of African-Americans in this little school. Well, getting back to the question of, you know, this kind of moral concern of your father's to integrate, to put you in an integrated school. Do you think that he saw himself as an activist?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. I feel pretty confident that he never used that word for himself.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a fairly modern word.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you may have investigated this a lot more than I have. I mean, who was the first person to call him or herself an activist? Do we know?
No, I did not look that up. But that's...
Yeah, I think that'd be interesting to go to the good old Oxford English Dictionary and see how my sense that it's a 60s term. And of course, Dad was, that's when he was active in the 60s. But he did not. I mean, for instance, when he was governor, from 70 to 74, so Kent State happened shortly after he became governor, and old conservative University of Virginia, where I would later go to school myself, erupted. Lots of very conservative campuses did. And he could understand why the students were angry, but he certainly wasn't, you know, out there with the students. I mean, they were a problem to be dealt with.
And right.
I remember talking to his buddy, Edgar Shannon, who was the president of they'd known each other in the Navy. Shannon was running UVA, and Dad was saying, the difference is, you know, if we were in the Navy, our shift would be ending soon.
Right.
And so anyway, they saw the activist in that sense, he saw as a challenge to be. I mean, you know, they're Americans, they deserve to speak, but they're a challenge to be dealt with. But he, I think, was an activist. If by definition, if your definition of activist is somebody who sacrifices everything for something they really believe in, then I think we can declare him an activist, even if he never used the word.
Right. Well, that's what I was thinking. And I, along those lines, what do you think is the difference between a revolutionary and an activist? Is there much of a difference?
Oh, I think they can overlap for sure. But that's another word that Dad wouldn't use for himself. I will say, though, that, you know, when you're governor of Virginia, as you're getting ready to leave, they paint your portrait and then they hang them on the third floor of the Capitol. And Dad's portrait is of him holding a biography. It was a 6-part biography of Jefferson. And the volume that he's holding is about Jefferson and the French Revolution. So it's called Jefferson and the Rights of Man.
Uh-huh.
He adored the American revolutionaries, but didn't think we needed, I don't think he thought in terms of we need another revolution. I don't think that was never that radical. And he remained a Republican till the day he died, which was just on October 28. For instance, was committed to the concept of competition, that you get better services if you have competition. And he's from a little town called Big Stone Gap, even smaller than Southern Pines, in the far southwestern corner of Virginia. And he would tell the story of the one drugstore town and the two drugstore town, where if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, you need a prescription. If there's one drugstore, you'll get it when the pharmacist wants to give it to you. But if there's two, you'll get it when you need it. And I, you know, I'm pretty attracted to that as well. But that things like that, I would not put him in the activist mode of you know, the Black Lives Matter people, although he was would be sympathetic to those kinds of ends. I think he was enough of a believer in the American idea that he thought that we could work within the system for the things that we needed.
Yeah, I think of activists insisting in some ways on working within the precepts of American ideals, so that they're begging, protesting, walking, placating, in order to get us to live up to, in some sense, our ideals of justice, and so that they're not revolutionaries in the sense of trying to turn over the government, but to rather enforce what is already a part of our standard understanding of justice and equality and liberty. I think we saw that in the 60s with the civil rights movement. It was not a revolutionary movement in that sense.
Yes, that's a great point. The civil rights movement was only revolutionary in the sense of the American revolutionary, that, you know, that Martin Luther King, of course, would quote the Declaration of Independence
right
all the time, and say all we want is all we were promised in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, so I think that is a distinction. And in your work, you often talk about what motivated the revolution. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the motivations versus kind of the ideals of the early American revolutionaries.
Oh, I'd love to do that. And let me start my answer to that with at the end. That is, so I just did this book called Liberty is Sweet, on the revolution. And one of my heroes in the book is a fellow North Carolinian of yours, actually, named Herman Husband. He'd been born in Maryland, but he moved to North Carolina, did pretty well, actually, but then became the penman of the Regulator Rebellion, which was farmers rebelling. They're on that line between activists and revolutionaries, in that they ended up going to war against the government of North Carolina, which was really crushing them with excessive taxes, attorney's fees, merchants who were suing people for debt, and you ended up losing your whole farm to pay off a small debt, things like that. So Herman Husband was an activist in North Carolina. They put out a sentence of death on him. And so he fled the state and ended up in Pennsylvania, where he participated decades later in the Whiskey Rebellion. So he's sort of a professional activist, also a religious prophet. But speaking about the people who'd written the Declaration of Independence and then the Constitution and had seemed so undemocratic to him, he said, though the men themselves are lost to all truth, reason, and justice, their work will stand the test and trial of fires. And I think his point there is we really need to separate the people from the principles. Mm-hmm. Because when you read what Thomas Jefferson wrote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, modified by Elizabeth Cady Stanton 72 years later to all men and women are created equal. And that they're endowed by with certain inalienable rights, among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I can't find anything wrong with that. That is, to me, the finest words ever written in the English language. And yet, over his lifetime, the guy who wrote those words owned 600 people.
Yeah.
I worry that a lot of people sort of in the establishment or the right or whatever say, whenever somebody like me points out his slaveholding, they say, well, that's, you're being anti-American. And I say, no, that's pro-American to hold people to their principles, because he's a guy who made it very clear that he believed in human equality, that he hated slavery, even as he continued to do it. But to answer your question, I'd like to say that my interpretation of the origins of the revolution and then later of the Constitution is not so much a cynical economic interpretation, although there's lots of economics in it. But what struck me researching my first book, which was called Forced Founders, was that people who we don't usually think of when we think of the politics of the American Revolution often had a huge impact on it. For instance, Virginia was 40% enslaved at the time. And yet, for a long time, if you read a book about Virginia and the Revolution, there'd be a chapter at the back about slaves. But it was very clear to me that they were part of that story from the beginning all the way through to the end. So, for example, and actually, I put a bunch of these up on Twitter now. My Twitter handle is Woody Holton USC. Where I've got one of the things I'm running there is I've got up to 76 quotes proving the point that I'm about to make to you, which is that African Americans could start to see that the American Revolution was coming long before the shooting started. And they saw in that opportunity for themselves to become free. And so Abigail Adams was actually the first to notice it, at least by our written records. In September of 1774, she saw that a group of Black Bostonians approached Thomas Gage, the British commander-in-chief, saying, "We will fight for our king if you'll offer us our freedom and hand us a musket." And other Blacks throughout the 13 rebelling colonies, long before they were rebelling colonies, made similar appeals to the British. And the British formally ratified that with an Emancipation Proclamation, November 15, 1775, Governor Dunmore of Virginia, and other governors and British ship captains made the same appeal to Blacks. Yes, you can come fight for us and we'll free you. And that infuriated white Virginians like Jefferson and Franklin. I mean, and also in Pennsylvania, Franklin and Thomas Paine talked about it in Common Sense. Their tremendous anger, as one Virginian put it, at the British for aiming a dagger at our throats through the hands of our slaves. So here's an example of African-American activism, which I think most of us would root for, enslaved people trying to be free. In their pursuit of freedom, they set in motion a series of events that leads the British to say, okay, we'll make this deal with you. And then that deal, that Emancipation Proclamation, infuriates whites and pushes their activism, because up until 1774, whites had been activists against the Stamp Act and the Tea Act and all those other things, but not seeking independence. And it's a big question, what pushes them over the edge from just trying to get Parliament to stop doing the stuff it's been doing for the last 12 years, like the Stamp Act and the tea tax and so forth? I think what white colonists were seeking until 1774 was restoration. Can we just turn back the clock to 1762 when we were happy and Parliament just stopped trying to change things? It was Parliament really that rebelled against the status quo of 1762. Anyway, what switched whites from wanting to restore the good old British Empire of 1762 to going over the edge and over the cliff into declaring independence? And one of the biggest things, and you can see it in the Declaration of Independence, one of the biggest factors that infuriated them into declaring independence was their anger at the British for this alliance with their slaves.
It's interesting to think that, I mean, going up against the British, that world power at the time, that they didn't consider, well, maybe we should make the same offer to the slaves. There's plenty of land here. You know, we can hire them. I mean, there's just a million different solutions than the one they came up with. I would think in some ways they could have thought about it as an opportunity to end slavery in a manner that would benefit them insofar as they would... It would seem they would have a fighting force that was much more powerful than the one that they had. But
well, and you did, especially in the north. I'm sorry.
It looks to me like the motivating factor is economics in that case, that the thought of losing all that property and all that labor was just the significant concern.
I agree with that. And in fact, I hadn't thought about this before, Mary, but now that you mention it, do you know the first entity in North America to completely abolish slavery, although a few slaveholders managed to hold on to their slaves into the 19th century, but at least it was official policy, no slaves. The first one was Vermont, where there were very few slaves. There were slaves in all 13 of the colonies that rebelled, plus Vermont, which was not one of the original 13 states. But my point is, you can almost do a direct correlation between how many slaves and how economically dependent right. you are. Vermont goes first. You could say Massachusetts, which borders Vermont, of course, it goes second. Their Supreme Court did it in 1783. And then on south from there to the last holdouts being South Carolina and Georgia, with the largest numbers of slaves and the biggest ambitions about what they were going to do with them. And it is true that you talked about freeing African-Americans and then hiring them. And of course, they were forced to do that at the end of the Civil War and paid them very little and did this sharecropping, which was another right. form of oppression. But I want to be clear that I'm not defending them, but to present their economic reality, land was so cheap in America. Whenever land's cheap, that makes labor expensive. So if they had freed all their slaves and then offered them free labor contracts, they would have paid them so much that Jefferson would never have built Monticello. Washington never would have expanded Mount Vernon into what it is today. And of course, that's a good thing. Yeah. That would have been a good thing. Much as I love those buildings, I don't love them that much.
Yeah.
But that's, they were not willing to make that trade.
That personal sacrifice was a bridge too far. Well, sure. I got to your work, not just through Ezra Klein's podcast, but also through the 1619 Project. And I noticed you're mentioned right in the foreword of the new book that's just come out with the 1619 Project. And that series of essays and poems have really brought this question of American history and the role of African Americans into the public arena in the last 2 years. And I wonder what you think about this renewed interest from your perspective as a historian. She's certainly gotten a lot of flack, right, for the historical accuracy. But from my perspective, it has really been a great way of shifting my traditional, very parochial understanding of American history to consider a much wider point of view. And I wonder, as a professional historian, what your understanding has been of the reaction, and do you welcome that reaction? Does it put us in conversation with ideas that we have just ignored?
I think it does that. And I would really, I've got this book I've tried to hawk myself, but please, if you can only buy one book for Christmas, buy the 1619 Project.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book.
It is simply amazing. And look, there were errors in the magazine version that appeared in 2019. The biggest one, in my opinion, was that they got persuaded by a couple of law professors at Rutgers who'd written a book arguing that there was a really strong anti-slavery movement in England and that that's what posed a threat to slavery here. And the editors of the 1619 Project and the magazine version sort of fell for that and posited that. And then the vultures pounced on that, as vultures will do. But the vultures were right on that one point. But here's my point. Here's the healthy side of the vultures. Because they came down so hard, you had U.S. senators, you had the president of the United States, you now have school boards all over the country banning the 1619 Project, and they feel validated in banning it because they've got all these highfalutin professors like Gordon Wood, who is a winner of the National Humanities Medal and the Pulitzer Prize, and one of my favorite historians of the Civil War, James McPherson. All these big shot of who was at Princeton, all these big shot historians jumped on the 1619 project. And so the negative side of that is it's really fueled a new wave of censorship. I don't know if you're familiar with a book, you would love it. It's called Ruby Bridges Goes to School. And it's by Ruby Bridges, who many people remember is the little girl who integrated the New Orleans schools, a black girl, and put into a completely different situation. I was never in any danger when I became the first white kid, right, or one of the white kids at a black school, but she was in extreme danger. She's pictured in a famous Norman Rockwell print, guarded by all of these federal agents. But anyway, she, as an adult, she wrote up her story, and it's beautiful and so inspiring and not at all negative about white. She does mention, you know, there was a white crowd screaming at her, but then she goes on to say, my white teacher welcomed me and the white kids didn't welcome me at first, but eventually did. And so it's this story of their growth and reconciliation. It's a beautiful story. And all over the country today, there are groups usually called Moms for Liberty that are trying to ban that book.
Wow.
And that began with, wow. I mean, that had been going on in a lot of ways before, but really got fueled by the college professors who what they called the 1619 Project magazine was pseudo history. That is fake history. And it's, again, the magazine version did make some mistakes, but this is what I wanted to tell you was the positive side of the vultures descending is that they were so careful on the book version. I was one of the sources. So of course I'm biased in favor of it, but they, I talked to Nicole Hannah-Jones, and then I had to talk to three fact checkers as well, because they kept calling me and said, you know, these finer fun, you know, you said very, by very, did you mean extremely or very as in,
wow.
I mean, incredible the level. I mean, I just think of the money they put into fact checking. It's the number one bestseller now, so they're getting their money back. But I'm hoping that they've cleaned up enough of the little tiny errors that it's going to be harder for the vultures to divert people from what's so beautiful about it, and which you've alluded to. It's a truly American and truly uplifting story. For instance, she talks about being one of the few black kids, Nicole Hannah-Jones does, in a Waterloo, Iowa school. And they were supposed to draw the flag of their home country. And, you know, the German American kids draws the German flag. And she goes, what flag do I draw? I don't, you know, I'm from many places. You know, she has partly white ancestors. I think most African-Americans do. And from many places in Africa. And she finally realized the flag she should draw is the American flag. It's an incredibly patriotic book.
Yeah.
If you think patriotic means the principles rather than the people who wrote down those principles, most of whom were slaveholders.
Yeah, I have found that fight, like many fights, the fight around, you know, the Black Lives Matter protests, they get us talking, you know, what pro or con, and the talking matters, you know, that this, and I wanted to ask you about your role as a historian. Where do you think the historian fits in this effort to tell the story of our history? And do you think historians should stick to just the facts, sir? Or should we have a more moral bent to our telling? And moral in the sense of not skewing history, but telling the whole story, the good and the bad, so that we're confronted with not just ideals, but with our moral failings. So we tend to think of our elementary and secondary school education, we think of history as edifying. But it's not always edifying. It's sometimes it's grotesque. Sometimes it's humiliating. But shouldn't we be facing that as well?
Yes. I don't think we do ourselves or even our founders, and certainly not our founders' principles. We don't do anybody any favors by covering things up. So that's the easy part of your question. And then we go to your harder question of should historians pass judgment? And I think there's room for that. And another way I'd put it is I think there's room for history with the author left in. You know, there's a book that's winning a ton of prizes now by Clint Smith called How the Word Is Passed. Yes. And basically he went and visited places like Monticello and Mount Vernon that we used to call plantations that we're now starting to call slave labor camps, because that's what they were for the majority of the people who lived in them, and reflects on it. And so I think there is tremendous room for that. There's a white guy, forgetting his name, Ball, I think, maybe, wrote a book called Slaves and the Family.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think there's room for those. But I also want to say, Gordon Wood asked me the same question, or he didn't ask it as a question. He made it as a statement. We had a debate back in October. And he said, you know what you're guilty of, Woody? You're looking for a usable past. And that phrase has been out there since the early 20th century. It was invented by a guy named Van Wyck Brooks, saying we shouldn't just collect facts. We should have a usable past that will help us in modern political debates. And I might surprise you, Mary, by saying I'm not into the usable past, in that I don't think we need to tilt things. We certainly don't need to fake things. If we just tell the truth, we're going to get a much broader view of the American founding, and we'll get refocused on the principles and away from the hero worship. And I'll give you an example of that. I mentioned the role of African Americans in bringing about the Declaration of Independence. They also played a huge role in transforming the Declaration of Independence after it was written, because what Congress did on July 2nd, 1776, was secede from the British Empire. And that's the document they wrote 2 days later. The Declaration of Independence is all about one nation that's in an alliance with another, or in this case, 13 little miniature nations, the 13 colonies, have a right to break away from another nation, the British Empire. So it's, in a sense, the Declaration of Independence as written is foreign policy. Can you, once you've made an alliance, can you break that alliance? And they're saying, yes, when things are bad enough, you can. Well, on the way to that foreign policy point that Jefferson and Congress make, one of the things that adds into that is all men are created equal, but that wasn't a focus of it. And in fact, after it was published on July 4th and circulated, read out loud to the army and all of that, people quoted it, but they tended to quote the clauses that justified secession. But one guy in 1776, Lemuel Haynes, who was an African-American soldier serving in the Continental Army, he quoted created equal at the start of a pamphlet that he had previously written called Liberty Further Extended. It was an anti-slavery pamphlet. And then Eric Slaughter, who teaches at the University of Chicago, started with that insight that the first person to ever quote created equal was a black man. He started with that, and he discovered, took it to the end of the 18th century, and I had a wonderful student assistant here do her own research and confirm it. So here's the thing. Of the people who quoted created equal for the rest of the 18th century, 70% of them were anti-slavery activists. African-American ones like Lemuel Haynes and Benjamin Banneker, and white ones like Quakers and other whites who had come around to opposing slavery. That the point is, it was these anti-slavery people, and then actually in the 19th century, women's rights people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who shifted the focus of the Declaration of Independence from a secession document. They turned it into a universal declaration of human rights. And so that's just a fact. Yeah. But it's a fact that's inspiring, and my mother used to always at Thanksgiving to go back to that, pull out the table and add another leaf. And that's all that historians like me are trying to do, is pull out the table, add another leaf so everybody can sit. Not faking a Black role or a women's role or a Native American role. We didn't talk about Native Americans yet. But recognizing the reality that they were at the table having an impact.
Right. Well, that, I mean, that is a kind of telling of the complete story that I think is an imperative. I would say that's an imperative, that we tell everybody's story, and that is a moral concern, that we are inclusive and tell the truth. So I think to get back to this question, maybe is it the role of the historian to have a moral perspective insofar as truth is part of that? And telling the truth in its entirety is a moral imperative. It sounds like you don't want to agree maybe to that language, but that it undergirds your work.
Well, let me give you the easy version, and then I'm going to pass on a very difficult for me proposition to you. The easy language is something I was just writing on somebody's essay this morning: show, don't tell.
Uh-huh.
Then we don't have to say that evil Jefferson cruelly owned slaves.
Right.
Just talk about the families that he separated, the father who never got to watch his kids grow up because Jefferson decided to punish him by selling him off to Georgia. You don't need to say that that was cruel.
Sure.
And inhuman. And here's the difficult proposition. A friend of mine who's really into the pursuit of objectivity. I'm into the pursuit of objectivity too, but he takes it to this extreme. He says, if I wrote a biography of Hitler, he won't, he's an Americanist. If I wrote a biography of Hitler, I would never say that what he did was bad. I would just say what he did and the reader would figure it out.
Right. Right. Yeah, I don't think it has to be, if judgment has to be passed, but I think the truth, the whole truth has to be told. And we haven't heard that entirety of the experience of every American in our ordinary history lessons. And I guess part of this concern around what we're teaching in school does involve you as a historian. We mentioned, or you mentioned before, about these school boards who are up in arms about critical race theory and what we're teaching in American history and the pulling down of statues, because that's part of our history too. And I wonder, you know, what you think about how history is being taught these days in America.
Well, let me say first that I think the most patriotic thing that anybody, that you or I or anybody watching us can do in the next year or so is go to school board meetings. Yeah. Because I don't think the people going to these meetings and screaming at the school boards to ban Ruby Bridges Goes to School and ban the 1619 Project, I don't think they're a majority, but they sure sound like a majority. If you're one of those unpaid or poorly paid school board members, probably a parent yourself, and you're up at the front and they're barraging you, they look like a majority. And the rest of us who are not screamers need to go and say, this is America, damn it. Oh, there I am screaming already. But it's America, did it. You can, if you want to go ban stuff, go to Iran. They're really into banning stuff in Iran, but we don't do that here. And it is heartbreaking to see that happening here. It's part of a broader movement that you're seeing in Hungary and Poland and other parts of Europe. But we need to be the island where it doesn't happen. Thomas Paine called us an asylum for mankind. And there are forces at work that are trying to stop that. And the place where all of us can have an impact is write a letter to the editor of the paper, go to a school board meeting and say, no censorship here, please. Now, you asked a harder question about the statues. There was a statue of Thomas Jefferson in New York City Hall for, I guess, decades. I'm not sure why it was there, because I don't really see a New York City Thomas Jefferson connection other than the broader one that we're all into, all men are created equal. Members of New York City Council made a pretty clear point that He owned 600 people. He knew it was wrong. And this is one of the most diverse cities in the world. And even most, I think, white New Yorkers are offended at celebrating somebody like that. And so first, I would draw a distinction between moving a statue to a historical society, which is what they ultimately did with that. That's not banning it. But I'll be honest with you and say, I don't like that either. What I would have done instead, and I'm going to see, am I able to share screen with you if I can find this thing fast enough? It may not be.
You probably can. Will I know what to do with it is another question altogether.
Well, let me see if no, it won't let me. It won't let me. But I'll find his name before we hang up, because there's an artist who does paintings, one in particular, that it looks, when you first look at it, it looks like a portrait of Jefferson. But then you can tell that the portrait of Jefferson has been sort of folded back the way you might pull a curtain slightly back to reveal something behind the curtain. And what's behind the curtain is a woman just looking at the screen.
Oh,
looking out at us. And it's an amazing. So one option for that Jefferson statue in New York, I don't know the context, and if it was right in their council chambers, this would have been tougher, but leave it up, but then put that painting behind it. Because, you know, that's what people talk about, contextualization. That would be pretty good context. I was just out in Columbia, the other Columbia, Missouri, and they tried to contextualize a local statue of Thomas Jefferson and the board of overseers, or whatever they're called, the board of curators out there said, no way, we're not going to let you contextualize it. But in the places where there's even any amenability to contextualizing that painting and things like it, would be one way to do it.
Yeah, well, this is happening all over. I happened to be in New Orleans when they were pulling down those statues a year ago or so. It is a strange feeling to see these venerable statues come off their high pedestals. There's not only triumph in seeing that. There's also a kind of sadness that they were ever up there and that they're not being replaced by anybody else. And this, we do need a search for new heroes that can stand for some of these ideals in a new way.
I think they're going to be replaced. I mean,
yeah,
I know
they need to be replaced.
Absolutely. I'm of two minds about needing new heroes, though, because I just told you how much I liked Lemuel Haynes, and I'm so excited about what he did to make the Declaration of Independence the document that it is today. But, you know, it's also worth noting that he later became a high Federalist. That is, among whites, they were the elite party that looked down on common people. And he was quite a snob in that different context. I mean, he was always against slavery, and that was the much more important issue. But the point is, everybody's, as we all know, all the heroes have feet of clay. And so you may not agree with this, but I kind of want to replace the statues of people with statues of, well, we can have allegories, like the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
No one's ever going to go, damn that Statue of Liberty.
Right.
She's a concept, and she didn't hit her kids or kick her dog or anything like that, because she's an allegory. And we've got, what is it on top of? Is it Freedom? I think is the statue on the top of the Capitol. It's too small for people to see. But I wonder whether and this is not my field at all, but the people doing the replacement art ought to be tilting more towards principles. And if that's too abstract, again, you can represent a principle as an allegory, or I think you can call a movement darn close to perfect. So for instance, I was on my brother-in-law when he was governor of Virginia. Don't worry, this wasn't a paid post, but he put me on the commission to kind of be his eyes and ears on the commission designing a civil rights statue for Virginia's Capitol grounds. And we came up with, I think, a great one commemorating especially Barbara Johns, who was a 16-year-old girl who led a strike at an all-Black school demanding, actually at that early point, not demanding equality. I'm not demanding integration, but just demanding a school that didn't leak, basically. And they went on strike, and it ended up being one of the five cases that went into Brown versus Board of Education. I think that's a safe statue. That 16-year-old girl is part of that movement. Yes, maybe somebody will dig up dirt on what she did later in her life. She's now passed away, and that's unlikely because I know her life pretty well, and it was a pretty perfect life. But my point is, I think she's, Barbara Johns is represented on one side of the statue, but the other side is a group of people. And I think groups might be a way around the fact that some generation may find out something horrible about the people that we might want to commemorate today.
Yeah, that's a
problem. Go ahead.
That's a good way to thread that needle, and emphasize the ideal over the person. Although I'm inclined to think that recognizing that we do have feet of clay, and even when we're at our best, we are still likely to make mistakes. That's not a bad thing to remember, that even with all our flaws, we can accomplish astonishing things. So I'm not opposed either way, but certainly they need to be contextualized.
Well, and speaking of contextualization, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. That's fine.
Okay. I would say two more things about the South Carolina State House grounds. My favorite example of contextualization anywhere has to do with Strom Thurmond. I grew up with his kids. They're a bit younger than me, on the same street in Northern Virginia when Dad was working in Washington. He was a senator. But as you know, he split out from the Democratic Party in 1948 over the issue of integration and used the N-word in speeches, you know, not just because he was a jerk at home or whatever, but, you know, he gloried in it. It was a horrific, horrific guy. And yet we discovered after his death that his first child had actually been African-American by the rules of the time. He'd had a relationship, we don't know, consensual or not, with his mother's housekeeper. So the point is, the statue of Strom Thurmond initially went up before that revelation. And so we have him and then his wife, and then the names of his kids. And they did go back and add Essa Mae Washington at the top of that list, because of course she was his eldest. And that, and you can tell that it was added at a different time. And that to me is the real statue of America.
Yeah.
Real quick on that, because I finally remembered, I don't know how I spaced the name of Wade Hampton. He's the guy who still gets celebrated in on the front of the South Carolina State House. And it's to our great shame that our legislature hasn't learned better.
Right, right. Well, these are questions about how we will interact with our history, right? These statues symbolize what we choose to remember and how we choose to think of ourselves. So I do think they are important questions for us to consider.
And we did pull down, you know, it took 7-9 people being murdered in
right.
Boston, but we did pull down our Confederate flag. So little tiny steps for little tiny.
Yeah. Although I'm not sure I think that's little. I think pulling that down is a big deal.
Fair enough.
And so it, of course, we hate to see the violence that, you know, propelled that idea. But
no, I agree. I agree. I just mean, how come we haven't got rid of Wade Hampton? But you're right. We got that. And that was something.
Yeah.
I took my kids and I felt like it was, you know, their version. You know, they woke me up at summer camp to watch the moon landing.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
It was an incredibly hot day, but it was so worth it.
Yeah, Absolutely. And one we'll remember. Well, Woody, I will end there, but I just can't tell you how much fun I've had thinking about you coming to talk to me today. And I just appreciate it so much. And I've enjoyed your books so much. And I've sent Sweet Liberty to my dad, and I've been listening to it. You and I have walked many, many miles together. You don't know that. But I got your books on Audible. And so I take a walk every day, and you've been my companion through Unruly Americans and Sweet Liberty. So hours of walking you and I have done.
I really appreciate that. I've had some great, the same person did Unruly Americans as my Abigail book. And she was a finalist for an Audie she's so good. And she told me that when she finished the book, she turned off the microphone and cried. Not because my book was over, but because Abigail was over. She'd like fallen in love with her so much. And
I'll have to listen to that next. We'll continue our walks then. I'll have a new book.
You make my day. I'm certainly not going to turn off the microphone and cry after this, because you've gotten me smiling. This has been a great conversation, completely different from the ones I usually have, where I go, buy my book.
Well, yeah, I'm glad.
Although I did get it in there.
I'm glad you got it in there at the end. That's very good. Well, it really has been a revelation to me. And I actually didn't know I was so interested in American history till I got hold of your book and the 1619 Project. It's been a very fun 2 years of looking into a new perspective for me, for the casual historical, reader.
That makes me feel a lot better, because there's been so much censorship, as we talked about, but the fact that you and maybe others are getting more interested in history, even as others are trying to suppress it.
Well, always, when you try to suppress something, don't we all know that from growing up as teenagers? Don't read.
Absolutely.
Read this. Whatever you do, don't,
That's true. Maybe they're secretly on our side.
Don't throw me in the briar patch, right?
That's right. That great African tale. Yeah.
Yes.
All righty.
All right. Well, Woody, thanks again. And I hope to see you sometime in Columbia, where my dad is. So
definitely look me up. We'll walk around that state house together.
That would be wonderful. All right.
See you, Mary.
Bye-bye.